Hello, everyone. My name is Brooklyn Myers, and I am an Elixir newbie. My goal is to help people adopt Elixir and grow as developers while doing the same myself. I do that by documenting and sharing my own experience in the Elixir industry. It's been an incredible journey so far, and I look forward to taking the next step with you. So, let's jump in to the Elixir Newbie Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Elixir Newbie Podcast. Today, I'm joined by John Darrington, the lead digital systems architect at Idaho National Laboratory. He is pioneering the use of Elixir in a large application called Project Alexandria at INL, and he's also pushing forward the AI and ML used to create a digital twin, which is a virtual replica of ISU, which is Idaho State University's AGN-201 nuclear reactor. Welcome, John.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's awesome to be here and awesome to interact with those that are coming into the Elixir world.
Really thankful to have you here. When I was reading about your involvement at INL, so much of it was incredibly fascinating, but also so far out of my usual wheelhouse. It's really exciting to see Elixir being used in kind of outside the scope of web, although I think there is web involvement, I should say, just more so going in such an interesting direction. So I'm sure I'm going to be asking a lot of, you know, very basic questions about something that is incredibly high level. So I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to be here.
So can you start us off by talking a little bit about Idaho National Laboratory and the work that you do there?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Idaho National Laboratory has been around for quite a long time, ever since nuclear power was basically a thing in the States. We own enough land in Idaho to be roughly the size of Rhode Island. We have a facility out in the desert that does a lot of nuclear, you know, we have a test reactor out there. We have some other things out there. And then we have a lot of in-town facilities in the town of Idaho Falls. And we do a lot in the realm of clean energy, of nuclear energy, of basically anything that touches along that. So hydrogen, lots of different things that go there. We have a high performance computing cluster. It's not one of the fastest in the world, but it is still one of the bigger ones that we have. And it's really interesting to see the different kinds of work coming out of there. We also have a physics modeling program that's internationally renowned called MOOSE. That we use and utilize in our systems, and as well as a bunch of other animal named softwares. So I work primarily with the digital engineering department. So we do a lot of things with digital engineering, and that comes down to like MBSE tools. We've done a lot of data management platforms, data management projects. I helped develop, design, and build a data lake that is unique to INL called Deep Links. And I did that one in Node. I did not do that one in Elixir. Sorry.
It's perfectly fine to have, you know, outside interests, as long as Elixir gets to be a piece of things.
Well, I'd much rather have designed it in Elixir, to be honest. The Node was not my choice, unfortunately.
Would you say it sounds like you're very much responsible for the introduction of Elixir kind of into the into what INL is doing? Would you say that's the case, or am I kind of misreading the situation?
No, you're absolutely right. So I am responsible for the introduction of Elixir into the digital engineering department and INL as a whole, because I am not aware of any other group or department or division within INL that's using Elixir currently. We are the first to pioneer its use here. And we were among the first to also pioneer the use of Rust. So in my departmental clinical work and in my work at INL, I have constantly been trying to find the right tools for the job and try to find, even if they're newer tools or, you know, trying to make sure it's not all about, you know, new and shiny, but trying to find the right tool for the job. And sometimes that takes you in some interesting directions. And that's kind of how Elixir came into being.
So you came from a perspective of, I want to find the right tool for the job and landed on Elixir, as opposed to the reverse direction of, I really like Elixir, I want to fit it into this project, which is honestly a perfectly valid path for a lot of people. But just to confirm, that was kind of how things came about.
Yeah, absolutely. So with my early steps in Elixir and the way I kind of came into bringing it into INL, I had played around with Elixir probably about 4 or 5 years ago, Elixir and Phoenix at the time. So this was before LiveView. This was before, you know, a lot of the cool features that we see today. It was before NX and Bumblebee and Axon. It was before any of this. And so I played around with Elixir when I was working for an e-commerce company, and I couldn't, it wasn't the right fit for me at the time. I enjoyed it. I loved the functional aspect of the language. I enjoyed the ecosystem. I think this was Erlang OTP 24 or 23. And so, I mean, it's just a while ago. And it wasn't the right fit at the time. So I kind of shelved it and put it back on the back burner until roughly 6 months ago, when I was looking for, basically trying to figure out, okay, I've got a limited amount of time and budget to build this application and this system. What tool can I use from my tool belt to make this work? And what can I introduce to the department if I have to introduce something new to find it function? And Elixir kind of just like fell into my lap. I was like, oh, hey, let's give this another shot. And then I ran into things like, you know, hey, we have NX, we have Axon, we have Bumblebee, we have LiveView now, which is making Phoenix even better than it was. And so it's been a really fun ride getting back on the Elixir train, so to speak.
Love to hear that. I'm glad it sounds like you're enjoying the experience of using it. How would you say the introduction of Elixir to those teams has gone? Like, what have been the benefits of using it and kind of the positives, but also what have been maybe like what negatives have appeared while using it?
That's an excellent question. So I would say, I like to start with the negatives because I think so I like to start with the negatives here. The biggest negatives I have is that we have smaller teams because we're project based at Idaho National Lab, and most national laboratories for the Department of Energy are project based, and that's how we bill things, and that's how we work with our people. It's harder to do sometimes things that are overarching for departments or divisions. And so the introduction of a new language is something obviously that's overarching, and it's hard to get that into project basis. And so trying to get people to jump on board is easy because they're like, oh, hey, this looks exciting. This can solve my problems. Getting them to actually use it in their projects can be difficult because, you know, we have deadlines. We have milestones that we can't afford to miss. And so it's very much a like, well, I can't take the time to learn this. And who's going to pay me to learn this? Because we have to charge all of our time to projects. And so no project is technically paying you to learn a language. They're hoping that you hire people that already know the language. And so it makes it somewhat more difficult sometimes to introduce even new technologies or new languages into our work because it's very project driven and the atmosphere makes it a little more difficult for things to pick up.
Gotcha. So it was difficult to kind of, people would be introduced to it and be like, oh, this is really interesting. But then that next step of we're going to use it on a project, there's just some kind of risk aversion there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's a new ecosystem. They have to get a new development environment set up. And Elixir has done fantastic jobs of streamlining things. But you know, is something to point out with Elixir is that it is a smaller language. It is a smaller subset of features. You don't see, you know, GitHub runners that are specific. Well, there are some now, but they're very few. You know, you don't have a big wide choice of what can you do with you know, these tools in Elixir, and you're not pigeonholed into using certain things, but if you want something else, you're in charge of building it. And it makes it harder to dedicate that time.
Right. That makes sense. So finding things that are just ready to kind of pick up, that can be sometimes a challenge.
Yes. Yeah. And with our line of work, we don't have as much time to do greenfield projects or to basically build the foundation we need to start running with the project we're working on.
Gotcha. Okay. So in experience, so my understanding is you're using Elixir quite heavily in Project Alexandria. I'm curious to hear what the experience has been with that team, because that's one of the teams that it sounds like you've successfully introduced Elixir in, and a project that is very heavily using it. So those initial concerns of like, well, are we going to have off-the-shelf tools? What's it going to be like introducing a bunch of new people to using this dev environment? These are just classic programming problems. It almost doesn't matter what language you're coming from. Anytime you're encountering this, it's going to be a concern. How has that worked out kind of in practice for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So to just give a little background, Project Alexandria is a multinational lab collaboration project. So we have over 9 national labs from places like Lawrence Livermore to Brookhaven to Pacific Northwest. And we are attempting to build a data management platform for the Department of Energy. And anyone that's worked in data management before knows how tall of an order that can be. We're a lot of it is just gluing the right things together, gluing together a data catalog with data pipelines. But the part that we were missing in Project Alexandria is a good data ingestion story for a lot of our projects. So we started to develop and build a data ingestion platform to capture things like metadata and information about the data from the users that are uploading it. And we actually started building that in Rust and React. But after about 2 or 3 weeks, I would say, and looking at the timeline of the project, we were not impressed with the speed we were able to move. It was yet another SPA and API project, and all the stuff that we have to do on the back end. We had adopted Rust a while back, which is fantastic, and we use it quite a bit. And we still have Python around, but we didn't want to write the back end in Python because we needed the high performance and fault tolerance. And so we're like, okay, well, we'll utilize Rust. But again, it's not that big of a deal. And so we started to get into a position of like, okay, we have limited time, we have limited resources. How do we deliver this in that short amount of time? And that's where Elixir and Phoenix especially came into being. And so that's when we adopted Elixir, that's when we adopted Phoenix and introduced it to the team. And I was the one that basically made that decision of like, nope, this is what we're using. I spent a few weekends playing around with Elixir and Phoenix, reading up on it, making sure that it was making sure it was a good call. I haven't regretted it yet, but yeah, we can talk a little bit more. So I'm going to give you just a second for a question, and then we can go back and talk more about the actual difficulties of starting that project. And I know I just wanted to give a little background on Alexandria and kind of where we're using Elixir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a very good kind of segue back into, I do sometimes have the memory of a goldfish when talking. So people are very used to me at this point on this podcast, starting a sentence with like, okay, well, first, and then never saying a second, for example. So the original question, just to kind of bring us back, was the positive and negatives of introducing us to Elixir. We started with some of the negatives and some of the kind of friction. I think this is a great segue into the positives.
Yeah, and there's a lot of positives that I've found. So one is the speed of development. We have a limited time and a limited budget to deliver our minimum viable product by the end of the year. And Elixir and Phoenix has allowed us to move incredibly quickly in delivering that project because I'm not building yet another REST API with a SPA that has to do things like, you know, we have to have API management. We have to have an OAuth flow. We have to have token management. We have to have all of this stuff that some libraries exist for it. Some don't, but then you're stuck with a library that's very opinionated. You know, you're stuck in this atmosphere of, okay, well, I'm going to have to redo all these things every time. And so we tried to build a template for it and it just didn't work out. But Elixir and Phoenix coming into especially LiveView and getting back to this, well, no, your server and your page, your templating doesn't need to be that separate. And it makes you just move incredibly fast. And so we have had a very small team working on this Elixir application. So we have a couple of other Elixir things, but on this Elixir application, we're calling it Ingest. And it is moved incredibly quickly with how fast people are able to use, you know, we're using like Tailwind. We bought all into the Tailwind environment. So, you know, we're using their components, which has made it move even faster. So I've just been incredibly impressed with the speed of development of Elixir and Phoenix.
When it's so fascinating that you get to have that comparison, right, where you started with a Rust and you said Rust and React?
Rust and React, yeah.
A Rust and React project, wasn't happy with the speed of development. By the way, very brave decision. I think a lot of people at that point would be like, well, I guess this is what we have. This is what we started with. But very rapidly pivoting and using a different technology and getting that immediate feedback of, oh, yeah, like this works. It works for these reasons. And so this is kind of it's becoming a trend story within Elixir. We switched to Elixir, we have a small team, and we were able to build something that would have otherwise been incredibly difficult to accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what it was. I mean, I agonized about that decision for about 3 weeks and while still building the Rust and React application and having the prototype of the Elixir application on one hand and talking, you know, to my other developers and them running through the Elixir. One of them ran through the Elixir and Phoenix, one of the books that is out there. He's like, well, it's a little old, but I really like it, you know, because he was using an older version. It's like, well, my version's a little older, but I like it. I agonized about that decision for three weeks, because like you said, it's hard to make that pivot and make that call when you've already put together a lot of work. So, but I don't think there is much regret in the team or myself at all of making that pivot.
When do you think that helped with some of the negatives we had talked about before, convincing other developers to, you know, switch to a new technology, always not an easy thing to do. And also just getting dev environment set up, having off-the-shelf tools, like you talked about using Tailwind and how that improved your kind of speed and flow. Did you find once you actually got to introduce it on a project that those initial kind of concerns, like negatives, how has that been? Were there frustrations with dev setup? Were there frustrations with not having the right tools? Or have you not yet run into those issues?
So there's been a little frustrations on there. One of the things that we have here at INL is, and a lot of people have, is we're behind a corporate firewall, and it's a very strict corporate firewall, and it does, you know, things like SSL inspection and all of this stuff like that corporate firewalls do, and that makes it sometimes hard for Elixir and the underlying Erlang libraries to get out there, because you have to custom CA certificates. kits. And so we've ran into a few problems where getting the dev environment set up has been necessarily easy. Getting it outside the firewall and working with underlying Erlang libraries and getting things. I worked with a couple of library owners to make sure that we could include custom CA certificates just so that we could make it work in our environment. So that was kind of our big thing, was just making it work in our security environment. The dev environment wasn't as big of a deal. The deployment environment was a slightly bigger deal because we primarily run things like Kubernetes and so getting it into our deployment environment, making sure that we had build pipelines that would work with it. The Dockerization of Phoenix has been fantastic for us. That whole deploy step has just been amazing for us. It's really helped us out, but I would say it's helped with the negatives now that we've adopted and moved forward and got a lot of this set up. But at the same time, it is still a leap of faith, because as much, I guess, power as I have in our department and our ability to move direction or move development in certain directions with languages, I'm still not the principal investigator on all these projects. And so I don't have the final say. It's up to their bosses. So a lot of my time is spent convincing stakeholders, not developers. Developers I've found have been the easiest to convince, that has like, okay, this might be a good direction for us to take, and let's give it a shot. As long as they like the syntax. If they don't like the syntax, then it's really difficult to get them on board. But a lot of my time has been spent convincing stakeholders that this decision is a good one.
Interesting. So it's more coming from the kind of business perspective than it is coming from the just tech and developer perspective. Developers are already on board to try something new. You know, stakeholders may be a bit more risk averse.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially in this project-driven area. So it's a lot of my work has been showing, hey, you know, this is fault tolerant. Look at what we can do. Look at how fast we're moving. Look at how few developer resources we need to deliver something fantastic. You know, trying to convince stakeholders that, hey, we've made a good decision. This is the right way to go. Let's move forward with it.
It's really wonderful to have this kind of case study of sorts, this example of, hey, we used Elixir and Phoenix and it was successful for our project. We went beyond the scope. It wasn't just on par. It actually pushed things forward in a way that we weren't able to achieve without it. It'll definitely be interesting to see if Elixir continues to be kind of spearheaded within INL, and if there continues to be more adoption mm-hmm. and appreciation within those projects.
I absolutely think there will be. I think once this application is delivered and they see how much we are able to do with the minimal amount of resources we had for it in the time period we had, I think that's going to impress quite a few people. And then, in my opinion, the machine learning story and AI and, you know, the AI ML story of Elixir is a powerful one. And as that continues to develop with Livebook and that nature, I think that can start to push into the Python dominated world, because it is a Python dominated world for AI ML here at Idaho National Lab. I mean, we've got some C++, and you know, some of our bigger solvers, you know, Moose is written primarily in C++, but Python dominates a lot of it. And so if we can give them an alternative that's a better story, that's a better experience, that, you know, can streamline these things, to me, it seems like a no-brainer.
I'm really curious to see where the AI and ML space kind of grows within Elixir. It's unfortunately something I have not gotten to dive into to the extent that I would like to, but I do work with people who are much kind of deeper in that NX and Axon space. Is that something that you've gotten to kind of already try out with Project Alexandria, or what's the kind of status of that?
So not so much with Project Alexandria. I have two projects. So I have a personal side project that I have, and then we have a digital twin. So a digital twin is a digital representation of a physical asset, and it has more than just a digital representation. It has things like live analytics and predictive analytics, and we did that of the Idaho State University's AGN 201 nuclear reactor. And that was primarily using Python at the time for its AIML pipelines, with Rust kind of being the dad, the supervisor, so to speak, of like, okay, I'm going to, because I didn't want to work with, I didn't want to trust Python directly and just run Python and have that in a Docker image or something like that. I needed something a lot more trustworthy, a lot more fault tolerant, a lot more manageable. And so what we've done is, and it'll be open source soon. What we've done is work with Rust as kind of in a supervisory role, in running the Python and machine learning, but looking at Elixir and Phoenix and Axon and Bumblebee, it's like, well, Why would I split the two up? I can have all of my cake and eat it too with, you know, things like the supervisory tree and keeping track of how things are working, and then use it for the machine learning portion as well. So, and then in my personal application, so I'm a beekeeper. I have a couple of hives and I really enjoy that. And one of the things that I enjoy with my hives is a constant struggle is making sure those hives are healthy. And so I've been developing an Elixir application for professional keepers to leverage AI and ML on photos and images of their hive to determine the health of the hive. And I bought all into Elixir and Phoenix at that point. And so I'm using Bumblebee primarily. I haven't had to dive too deeply into Axon yet, but I get the feeling I'm going to have to as I do some more custom model training and model fine tuning. I've been primarily like on the top of the iceberg with Bumblebee, and really enjoying my experience with that AIML story.
That is so cool. I have to jump outside of the tech for a moment and just appreciate the wordplay of using Bumblebee to build your beekeeping app. That makes me very happy. And two, I actually volunteered on a little small farm. It wasn't through the woofing program, but that kind of an experience for anyone who's familiar with that, kind of go live on a farm for a little while. They actually had beekeeping. And if you ever get the chance, if you're listening to this and you ever get the chance to do some beekeeping. Wearing that suit and just being surrounded by the buzzing sound of a hive, like there is no comparable experience. It is just so beautiful, very meditative. So yeah, wonderful to see that you're.
It depends on the hive. I had last year a very angry hive that was just not enough smoke in the world. And people have the experience that smoke calms the bees. That's a lie. It doesn't actually calm the bees. It triggers, basically their forest firefighting instincts. So it's very interesting, but it doesn't calm the bees. It kind of distracts them and keeps them away, and keeps them kind of like doing other things while you work with the hive. But, you know, it is a very awesome experience. I really enjoy it. So yeah, if you have the opportunity to your listeners, absolutely take it.
So, I think that is a great, way to jump into something I've been wanting to, talk about here, which is, so it sounds like the way you got exposed to Elixir was through that side project?
No. So my first exposure to Elixir was probably, like I said, about 5 or 6 years ago. I'm a polyglot. I like picking up different languages. In the time I was working primarily with Go, and I like new things. and I like trying new things. And so I think Elixir, it was either because of the advent of code, or it was on like Exorcism.io's daily courses or something along those lines that I first got introduced to it. And then I just started reading up on it at the time. And kind of that's where I was really introduced to it. It was about 5 years ago.
Gotcha. So what I wanted to kind of transition to and get to hear more about, I think it's very easy as a new developer to hear about someone who's working with nuclear reactor projects, creating a digital twin, and with this like Project Alexandria, and just these applications that function on a very high scale, right? These are advanced applications. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of different technologies being married together. It's very easy to look at that and be like, oh, you know, I could never get there in my career, right? I'm just going to build CRUD apps for the rest of my career and kind of be happy there. And there's nothing wrong with building CRUD apps, by the way. I have done mostly CRUD app work throughout my entire career. Because of that, I'd really love to hear, what was it like when you were a new developer? Like, how did you get started in the industry? What was beginner John? What did he experience and look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think beginner John was actually back in about sixth or seventh grade when I picked up my first HTML book. It was a book order. And if anyone's familiar with the United States way of doing book orders at schools, you get a little pamphlet, and you look at all the books and you get to pick one. And I picked my first HTML and I got how to build a web page. And so that was my first experience with code was building this HTML web page. And then I stuck around with code a little bit. You know, I would play around with it every once in a while. But it wasn't until I was about finished with school. So I didn't go to school for computer science. My degree is not in computer science. It's not in mathematics. My degree is actually in communications and public relations. That's my degree. it's not in computer science. But towards the end of my degree, I had started a little bit with a computer science degree, but it was going to take another additional 2 years to finish it. And we didn't want to go into debt at the time, with, you know, the joys of the American school system. Mm-hmm. But when I started to realize that, like, okay, public relations is fine and I can do well in communications, but I wasn't enjoying it as much. And so I picked up a job with a company called Netmark. I don't even know if they're still in business. And it was an SEO company. And I started off as an account manager with them. And I started to take on projects that had a developer role in them. And so what I did is in order to transition myself is I started to play around with code on my own time. So I helped my mom build a little website with like Node.js and Mongo, BB at the time. And, you know, it is at web scale. But I transitioned in that role to try to find jobs. And that's some of the advice I would give anyone is like, if you're trying to transition into developer work, that you find roles, you find jobs that can be alongside of that. But I didn't get my big break in the development world until about 2014. So yeah, 10 years ago. I want to say is roughly about that time period. And I got hired as a junior developer. I had a portfolio of side work. So my mom's application that I wrote something for school. So, you know, I had to have a capstone project for my communications degree. And I'm like, well, I'm going to write this whole service for developing kind of like newsletters. And it was very simple, you know, hooked up to like SurveyMonkey or whatever that application is called. MailChimp. It was MailChimp at the time. So it hooked up to MailChimp and, you know, it wasn't a very complex application, but I was really happy with it. So I had this little teeny portfolio and I'm like, my friend had gotten a job there and talked to, talked to the hiring manager and the CTO about hiring me. And so I got my big break as a little junior developer coming into a very big development world. I had not had a development job before then. But it took a lot of side work to get up to that point.
Really, really fascinating trajectory and kind of direction there. So you did get started fairly early. But I really love that your background in university is not actually programming, by the way. That's one of the things I think can really help people enter the industry in general. And obviously, like, you know, you reached out and your communication kind of background, I think, clearly has a hand in how you approach your career. And this is what I think a lot of people get hyper fixated on. Oh, I just need to know the tech. It's like, no,
absolutely not.
Blend the rest of you in there, right? Like I have a friend, Einar, actually, who I'm, he's former, Deckard Academy student and now an alumni. He has a strong background in he speaks Japanese and understands that culture. And that's always been a big kind of component of who he is and his personality. And I'm hoping to have him on the podcast soon to talk about this, but I'll give a bit of an early spoiler for folks. He has found his first, or technically not his first, but he has found a job. And one of the main, I think, benefits that he had was having that background in speaking Japanese. It's working with a Japanese company. I think he's going to be he's going to move out to Japan. So using the kind of other skill sets that you have and leveraging them with your career in tech, I think can it can propel you further than if you are just focusing on the tech side of things.
Absolutely. I don't know that I would be in the department. I don't know that I'd be in the position I am. I do a lot of traveling. I do a lot of presentations to various conferences within the DOE and DOD space, written papers. I don't know that I'd be as successful at doing that, like scientific papers and other kinds of papers. I don't know that I'd be as successful doing that without my background in public relations and communications. And then my background in kind of a managerial type role. So as much as sometimes I regret not going through for a CS degree because I missed certain things that I've had to pick up on my own, which hasn't been the end of the world, I still have been really appreciative of my own journey and how it's gotten me there. And I think it's important for some people to realize that at a certain point in your career, nobody gives a rat's butt about your degree. Nobody cares what your degree's in. Very Nobody's true. Looking at your degree unless you're going into some scientific, you know, INL will care about your degree. I will say that. Scientific operations probably will care more about your degree and your academia than a lot of places. But most other jobs and stuff, once you hit a certain point, nobody's like, they'll skim past that in your resume. Nobody pays attention. that I found.
Yeah, unless you're, you know, considering kind of that academia path. And I know that INL and ISU, Idaho State University, there's a lot of like collaboration between them is my understanding. So that it makes sense for there to be a bit more of that kind of academic spin. But this is something I'm quite vocal about. I didn't even go to university, let alone getting a comp sci degree or anything like that. I'm a boot camp grad going down that path. And I think there are huge strengths and advantages to going down that path. Like any path, there's going to be disadvantages as well. Like you have to be balanced about these things. And as you mentioned, though, like there will be things that you missed, gaps that you have, and you will pick them up. And that will be your career, you know. There's a ton of different entry points. So,
but you have to take the time to pick those up too. And I think that's important to note that as a beginner, I think you have to be a purposeful beginner. You have to have purpose in your beginning. You can't just go with the flow and expect you know, the world and the universe of tech to get you where you're going, or you're going to sink. I view it as kind of an ocean. You can't just tread water. You have to actively swim. And so if you're a beginner and you're listening to this or moving in that direction, be purposeful in your beginnerhood, I guess is a good way of saying it.
I really like that. Yeah, having intentions of what you want to learn and pick up.
Yeah, intentional. That's what I meant. I was trying to find the word, and I didn't want to start typing because I have a really loud mechanical keyboard, and I figured that would come through pretty well in the podcast. So I was like, okay, what is the word I'm looking for? I can't look up the cinnamon, so we'll just use this.
Too funny. So I would love to kind of keep going, and we've talked a little bit about the very beginning. We've talked a little bit about the very end. How was that transitionary period for you going from, you know, brand spanking new, you know, kind of, I imagine a little bit of deer in headlights feeling, like, I don't want to speak for you here, but I think everyone has that, like, oh my gosh, like, what the heck am I doing? Feeling when they first enter the industry. Although maybe you didn't, again, not trying to speak for you. And you know, how has that kind of transition been from beginner to where you are now?
Yeah, so I definitely had the deer in the headlights look. I think the single most important aspect of my transition from being new to the industry to being skilled in the industry has actually been the introduction of various mentors throughout my career. When I started at the e-commerce, or when I started at Netmark, when I was the account manager, there was a couple of really good people there that helped me out. When I moved into my next role, which was that junior developer role, there was a very just powerhouse of a developer. You know, he was a senior engineer. He knew what he was doing. He'd been there for a while. He'd done a lot of other things, and just his mentorship and his example did more for getting me out of beginnerhood than I think anything else that I would have done. And I think that speaks to the skilled people listening to this podcast. Like, you have a huge impact on those around you, and the beginners in this podcast, find those people and find those examples that you can follow, because I personally learned more and learned better from doing and learn and from these other people than I did from books or from a class or anything along those lines. And so my transition was facilitated mainly by other people, I think.
I think that's a very shared experience within the industry. Very few people, if anyone, you know, do it on their own. It's very much something that you get inspired by other developers, you learn from other developers. And the opposite side of that relationship, I think, can be phenomenally beneficial too. This is something I talk about with my students at Dockyard Academy, is that my goal in teaching them is to really just help them get their first job, right? Because there is so much that you learn once you have your first job. The speed of learning ramps up so fast from that point forward. And as much as I do my absolute best to provide a good learning environment and help them pick up what they need, there just is no replicating a real work environment. So, you know, we exist to kind of bridge the gap between those two points of not having a job and having a job. But there's so much you get from that. And to speak to the other side, I'm really curious how it is for you now that you're at a stage in your career where you can actually be the mentor. I know you collaborate with Idaho State University, and I imagine you get to work closer with people who are kind of coming from that background. I'm making a bunch of assumptions here, so I'll just let you.
No, you're good. I think it's good to be in this side of my career, but what I didn't realize at the time is that mentorship has to be a very deliberate and constant action. Because my time is taken up. I mean, on Tuesday and Wednesday, I had roughly nine or 10 meetings a day, this week, and trying to find time in there to work with other developers, to mentor them, to be examples, to show them different techniques is extremely hard. You have to be extremely deliberate now with your time and guard that time a lot more closely than you used to. Because when I started out, and even as a mid-range developer, I'd have a few meetings, but most of my time was actually built, you know, in the trenches, building stuff and doing the development work. Now, oh my gosh, my time is high level. My development time, I have to guard with, you know, I have to block out time on my calendar and pretend I'm not here sometimes to make sure I get that development time. And so what I didn't realize and what I'm so thankful for now is those mentors and how deliberate they were in their mentorship. And learning that now and having that opportunity and seeing developers grow. I've got to witness, we have an internship program here. If you're interested in internships, you can feel free. You can put my email in the chat, in the show notes. You're welcome to reach out to me about internships. We can do on-site or fully remote. But we do an internship program, and I have seen interns just grow so much from coming in and knowing barely anything about code to now working on this data lake, working in this atmosphere, building new features. It's been an awesome experience to be in the middle of that and watch people grow, but it has to be a deliberate experience. Like, you have to make that effort.
That sounds like a really phenomenal opportunity. I'll definitely include links in the show notes so that folks who want to get involved can reach out. We're getting closer. We're not quite there, but we're getting fairly close to the end of our time. So I wanted to give you an opportunity. Is there anything, because we've talked about the work you're doing at INL. We've talked about the Digital Twin Project. We've talked about I always like to talk about people's early career. We've covered mentorship. We've covered Project Alexandria. I want to give you an opportunity to kind of steer the ship as we close into the dock.
If I was going to steer the ship, I would want to talk a little bit about, you know, we've said the word deliberate and intentional a few times here with regards to mentorship and other things. And I think that you have to be that. My biggest advice, I think, for new developers, and new developers to Elixir, especially, is figure out and know how things work. Don't just stay at the top level. You know, you get into a Phoenix Live view, for example, and you run the generator and you kind of use that live template. Don't stop there. Figure out why they did it the way they did. Figure out how it works. You know, why are they using the live action? How are they using the live actions? You know, and then just dive deeper, you know, use your editor to dive into actual functions. And I know that can be somewhat hard in Elixir because, you know, the editors can be sometimes a little tricky. But use your editor to dive in there, ask ChatGPT, you know, whatever you need to do to dive down into the root cause of these things. And I think that the reason that I've been as successful as I have been in development is because I tried really hard never to stop at the top level. So if I'm working with an interface, I don't stop at the interface. I go look at the implementation and I look at the different implementations and I dive deeper into the SDKs. What I've found a lot of new developers are, is they're scared to look at other libraries' code. You know, they'll just use the library. They won't actually dive down into the library or think that the library is wrong. One of the biggest aha moments in my career was working with somebody's library and thinking, you know, and having a bug and having an issue with the code and then realizing, wait, this isn't my issue. This is an issue with the library. And then diving into the library, able to figure out the issue and open a patch into somebody else's library was a huge confidence builder and aha moment that had I not been willing to dive into somebody else's code and dive deeper, would I never would have had. And I don't think I would have ever had that confidence boost of like, oh, hey, I can help other people. And I understand other people's code and I understand these libraries. So dive deeper. Don't just stop on the surface level. You have to understand how things work. I'm not talking, you don't, unless you're working with Rust, you probably don't need to get down into the stack and the heap and get down into deep memory, unless you're doing systems programming, in which case you absolutely do. But, you know, with Elixir, learn the kernel, learn how it works, learn the underlying Erlang technologies, you know, take the time to understand the libraries you're using and look at their code and how they did things. And I think that's a big part of improving your skill set.
That is such a wonderfully inspirational statement. Frankly, something that I, at my stage of my career, I have definitely grown in, but something that I think I can still apply to my own kind of path and progression through my career. So this is something that I think even experienced devs need to be reminded of as well, because it's mental effort to not just use your tool and go, cool, I understand it, I know how to use the tool, you know, but then, you know, you take your screwdriver and you open it up and you look at the internal work. I mean, maybe the screwdriver is the wrong example here, but you get my kind of point.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I'm actually struggling with this. I have a fairly relevant story building out the guides and documentation for Live View Native. So Live View Native is a project spearheaded by Dockyard. We're bringing Live View to mobile development. So
which I can't wait for. Awesome. I'm way excited for that.
Awesome. I think you'll appreciate some of the work coming out then. So I'm working on the guides and documentation. Now, I didn't build any of this project, but I'm in the position of needing to understand it deeply and be able to teach it. And this is one of the reasons that I think mentorship and teaching is so valuable is I struggle with the instinct to go deeper. Right. If I can use something, that's often good enough for me, especially with deadlines and things like that to manage. So when you have to teach something or when you mentor others, that really, when you actually have to explain it, you'll realize, oh, I thought I understood this, but you know what? I don't understand it as well as I thought. It encourages you to go that extra level deeper to understand how things are working behind the scenes, which building these guides is very much kind of encouraging me to do right now, to really understand, like, okay, how did Carson and May build these things and the other members of the team as well, of course. More so that Carson and May are just the two people I probably bother the most with my questions. So yeah, I think that is a very inspirational kind of closer to end us on here. Are there any last shout outs or calls to action or kind of things that you want to put out for anyone listening to this podcast before we call it to a close?
No, I think just, you know, keep working hard, keep diving in. Like I mentioned earlier, we are always looking for powerful interns. If you're interested in an internship with Idaho National Labs, please feel free to reach out. I'm more than happy to discuss. I'm more than happy to work with anyone and to mentor and to talk through systems and stuff like that. So please don't hesitate to reach out.
Hugely gracious of you, John. Very much appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast and share your experience, your story, and some of the work that you're doing at INL. That is going to be it for this episode of the Elixir Newbie podcast. I want to thank you all so much for listening. I hope you Elixir Newbies out there enjoyed this episode and learned a lot. I know I did. If you want to learn more about John and his work at INL, like I said, links will be in the show notes. And I hope you all have an excellent rest of your week.